Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 384 of the podcast. It's Friday, the 13th of July, 2018, as I record this. So coming up, I am talking about the artist's journey with the wonderful Stephen Pressfield. And of course, I'm a fangirl, and you can always hear that in my voice when I talk to Steve. You might know him from The War of Art or Turning Pro or one of his many novels. And he's also been on the podcast twice before. So if you enjoy this one, go back and listen to the other two. So I am a fangirl. I try and ask good questions that he hasn't been asked before, and I definitely managed to challenge him on his shadow side. So that is coming up. Right, in publishing news, a couple of interesting things this week. I think the end is near for CreateSpace because this week KDP Print now has expanded distribution within the USA and a large print checkbox. So I've obviously talked before about doing large print editions and how it just wasn't available on KDP Print. So I was doing mine on CreateSpace and Ingram Spark. And now it looks like you can do both on KDP Print. I went and had a look. So that's really interesting. There's speculation as to when CreateSpace might close. There's nothing official, but certainly if you are looking to publish print books with Amazon, obviously Ingram Spark, I do all my print now with Amazon and Ingram Spark. So my process at the moment is to publish on KDP ebook on KDP, obviously ebook on the other platforms. And then I do my print book on KDP Print. I then do another version on Ingram Spark. And I do my large print, my workbooks on CreateSpace and Ingram Spark. So my process going forward is just going to be probably KDP Print and Ingram Spark. So those two things. And of course, remember, Ingram does distribute to far more places than CreateSpace or KDP Print. So this is an interesting thing. It's not a surprise. We've seen this coming, but if you are publishing in the near future, I probably wouldn't start with CreateSpace. I would probably just get into KDP Print. And it's not difficult. It's not a big deal. So there we go. The other interesting thing is BookFunnel have introduced print codes. So this is great if you do live events. So this is for giving away ebooks. Each of the codes are unique and non-shareable for your books. So you can print them on postcards, bookmarks, business cards, and you can do giveaways at events. So if you're doing conventions, if you're speaking, if you're at, writers events, this is a really good way to give away copies of your book. Really like this idea. I think it's something that many people have wanted because obviously giving away print books is very expensive, but this means you can give away ebooks at events without too much trouble and save your printed copies for the real influencers or people with a big Instagram channel. I should say I've been trying to use Instagram a lot more recently. Just off on a tangent now. I just posted a picture of my writing setup at a local cafe where I write in the mornings, and just trying to incorporate much more into Instagram in terms of my fiction. So I'm at JF Penn Author if you want to check me out on Instagram. But I do think that I prefer this visual marketing side of things, and I know many of you do too. We use up so many of our words in our books after all. Okay, I did want to, there's so much futurist stuff going on right now, but I know most of you are not so interested in the futurist stuff, but I am. So I am going to continue sharing futurist bits and bobs. So this came up and I thought this was fascinating. You know, I am bullish on AI translation, which again, I'm very early on this, you know, thinking that it's going to come, thinking that it will disrupt the translation world. I think it will. I do see a point where we will be reading ebooks on devices and it will automatically translate. Now, this is a development that will feed into this type of technology. So Google has revealed Google Duplex. I'm not sure I like the word duplex. To me, it's the, you know, the two-story house thing. But anyway, Google Duplex says, reported by Digital Trends, a huge step in terms of AI's ability to more naturally converse with humans. And the demo featured a human-sounding robot having a conversation with a person who couldn't even tell they were talking to a robot. The computer system sounds like a human, uses a natural tone, and uses phrases like and ah, just like a human person. A human person as opposed to an AI person. During a conversation, the AI system can also handle interruptions and elaborate. So I think this is fascinating, and it also means that we will, as Jim Cookwell from the Selma Book Show has talked about, AI narration of audiobooks will also sound more natural. So this is really interesting. It does say the main thing Google Duplex will do for you is handle some of your busy work. It can make calls on your behalf, schedule appointments, or call to check the hours of operation at a business. And they think it will be replacing, you know, some basic call center stuff. We're all kind of used to the robocalls now. I mean, I don't even answer my phone. I mean, we are our landline. We had to have a landline to get the internet, which is really ridiculous. But our landline is attached to a sort of answer phone thing. So it rings and it goes straight to the answer phone and the answer phone says, sorry, you can't leave a message. And both of our cell phones are on permanently do not disturb. So basically, you know, we don't get the robocalls, but I know they exist and I have heard them. But this will be interesting because this is slightly different. This is going to be more like a conversation. But in terms of authors and why I'm interested in this, to me, this AI natural language processing, both on the reading side, so the narration, for example, and also the translation side, these are the things that are going to impact us in the future. And again, it will be the future, but hey, I'm 43. I'm intending to live into the future. And I fully expect this type of stuff to be happening in my lifetime. I hope it's sooner. I mean, like, I don't mean I want to see this by the time I'm 90. I expect this to be happening in the next 5 to 10 years, I guess. But who knows? Okay, so my personal update. Sighs. It's been a difficult week, to be honest. It's been a bit up and down. I am working on Penny Appleton with my mum, and I will be talking about that in detail in the next couple of weeks. Can't talk too much about that right now. I've also been working on Valley of Dry Bones, which is my next arcane thriller, and I am super loving it. And I've had some writing sessions this week. I talked last week, I think, or whenever, about the synchronicity of going to Spain, going to Palma, and finding cool things that tied into the story I thought I'd invented. So often this happens to me. I think I've made something up and then I find evidence to support it. Well, I found more evidence this week, which connects the Spanish Inquisition with New Orleans, West African voodoo, zombies and Catholic ritual and relics, obviously. So I really love to base my novels in truth and then to take what is true or what is history. I mean, who says a lot of history is written by the victors, obviously, but take historical events and then twist them. And so I'm writing scenes in New Orleans, writing scenes in Spain. And I fell on this one piece of research and I was literally like giddy with excitement in the cafe. So I've had this difficult week in one way and I've had this really fun week in another way. But I'm in that creative fun process. I'm at around 11,000 words into the book. So really at the beginning where I'm still working out what I'm actually writing, but I'm loving it. It's really, really fun. So if you heard the show, about a month ago when I was in that finishing energy and I was talking about how stressful it was and finishing all the bits and bobs, well, this is the good side. This is the fun bit. So yeah, having fun with writing. If you are interested in my fiction at all, then there is a wonderful story bundle, a limited time deal. If you haven't done story bundle before, it is essentially a number of ebooks, so 10 to 15 ebooks that you get for a kind of pay what you want price. There are suggested prices, but a percentage goes to charity. The authors get more money than selling. It's a version of selling direct, but it goes through story bundle. So my book Map of Shadows, which is a dark fantasy thriller, is in this latest one. It's at storybundle.com/fantasy. So there are 14 books in this, 8, 10 individual books and a box set. And they really span the range of fantasy, from historical fantasy to contemporary epic fantasy to grimdark, which is very cool. Some in imaginative second worlds. Oh, that will be me. Others in the real world that are wizards, witches, vampires, murderers, ghosts, detectives, sorcerers, thieves, zombies, monsters, fallen angels, and lots more. So very excited about this. I very much enjoy being in the fantasy niche for Map of Shadows, as my friend Lindsay Broker has told me before. And I think I've mentioned this on the show, but it's hilarious. When I was talking about my book, she said, "You do know you're a fantasy writer, don't you?" And since then, I've really embraced it. I feel like, okay, yeah, actually, I do have stuff that's not actually real. Anyway, back to the other stuff. So that is the useful stuff this week. storybundle.com/fantasy. Right, thank you for all your emails and tweets this week. Some really interesting comments. Kirsten Lillis says, "Such a timely episode for me. I sent inquiries to editors this week and listened to the podcast yesterday. Great advice and reassurance. I'm ready to take the step." Fantastic. Matt Quintana messaged me and said, "Really enjoyed the great interview with Natasha. Have a question. I like the chat about visualization and focus. Is there a book you recommend?" Okay, so the book I recommend is The Success Principles by Jack Canfield, which is now in its 10-year edition. But that was the book that really got me into, visualization, and has some fantastic, it's just brilliant. I still recommend that book. I still reread it. The Success Principles by Jack Canfield. Brooke Duncan says, "Listening to the interview while out for an afternoon stroll in rural Queensland. It's perfect timing as I'm working through editing my first manuscript. Love the show." Thanks, Brooke. Pete Bauer says, "Your podcast of late have been awesome. They're always good, but you've been on a roll this past month." Oh, thanks, Pete. I appreciate that. And it's funny because I do, obviously, part of the reason, and I read out the a few lovely emails, and I often get far more than I can read out. So thank you to everyone who does send them in. But I do also get critical messages, obviously, and I welcome those too, although I generally ignore them. But it's funny because some interviews really split the crowd. So sometimes people are like, "Oh, that interview was just terrible. You should never do that." And at the same time, I'll get a message which will be like, "That was the best interview ever." So I have learned in my interview process to just let it go. Whatever I think about it, somebody will find something interesting. Otherwise, you can just fast forward. What else have we got here? So Wendy Ledger says, "Listen to your podcast while walking on this trail near our new home in Gold Country, Sonora, California. Locals call this trail the Ditch, but I think it deserves a much lovelier name," which is just wonderful. And final one. Beth Green sent a lovely picture of her walking and said, "I owe you and Ewan Lawson a big thank you. Your Healthy Writer book pushed me to start walking more. Here's a photo from last week when I walked the Camino Inglés in northern Spain with a group of friends. While training, I listened to the podcast a lot." So I am super chuffed about that. The Healthy Writer focus definitely has made a massive difference to me. We were at a yoga class this morning, and I am definitely much more in touch with my physical self since I started writing The Healthy Writer and really paying attention to it. So really glad that helped. Right, so today's show is sponsored by Ingram Spark, and a very good timing with the KDP print stuff, because what it's going to mean, as I said, is that we will likely use KDP print plus Ingram Spark for, things that KDP print doesn't do, like distribution to bookstores, universities and colleges, libraries, and anywhere that requires a discount. And that is one of the benefits of using a service like Ingram Spark. It's much more where the bookstores order, where libraries order. If you want to do things like sell direct into schools, like the lovely Dave Hendrickson, who was on episode 377, that is a really interesting episode if you want to order bulk books and make some money that way. So if you require a discount, if you want to do bulk ordering, if you want to get author copies at a much cheaper price, then Ingram Spark does great stuff around that. I use it for, as I said, all my print, including workbooks, large print, normal paperbacks. And some people have asked me how you do print on demand in other countries. Well, it's exactly the same. You just put it on Ingram Spark and you can use the global distribution section. So you can reach a really wide market if you use KDP print, which will basically just be for the Amazon sales, and Ingram Spark for your print. So they also have fantastic help, and they have an awesome podcast, Go Publish Yourself, which I think is hilarious. So it's your content. Do more with it through ingramspark.com. So thanks also for everyone supporting the show on Patreon. And I did the extra Q&A audio yesterday, so that has gone out. If you are a patron, you will get that extra audio. I've also started doing little bonus audios during the week. So I really am trying to reward those of you who do support the show. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you want the show to continue, and you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month. Thanks to new patrons, Steve Barden, Marvin Aaron, Jane Hinchy, Margot Letts, The Curious Rambler, Chachana Simpson, and Chachana, I just love your name. I'm going to have to put it in a book. I love it. I want to dance. Having a name that sounds like a dance is awesome. Ian Howlett, Leanne Kowal, Melanie, Amy Teagan, Alyssa McColl and Elena Kaufman. And thanks also to Matt R. Miller and Olivia Williams for increasing their pledges. I am, as ever, so stoked when you guys support the show. It is just, it has become increasingly important to me, and a reason we are heading towards episode 400, that's for sure. You can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview with Stephen Pressfield. Today, I'm back with Stephen Pressfield. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Joanna. It's great to be with you today.
Thank you so much. And just a little introduction for anyone who doesn't know Steve. Steve is the author of non-fiction works, including The War of Art and Turning Pro, which everyone should read, and novels around the classical wars of ancient Greece and modern warfare like Gates of Fire. And his latest book is The Artist's Journey, The Wake of the Hero's Journey and the Lifelong Pursuit of Meaning, which is just fantastic. Oh, there it is. It is. So, Steve, I've read all your nonfiction books. I'm such a fan. And this one feels like the most spiritual of the books. So why now, in this time when it feels like most nonfiction is all about productivity hacking and, you know, you've gone deep?
You know, when you sent me that question ahead of time, Joanna, I wanted to ask you, what exactly is productivity hacking?
Oh, brilliant. Well, it's things like, you know, if you...
Whatever it is, I hate it, but tell me what it is.
Well, you know, like if you tweak, if you time this and if you eat this and if you do this, you'll get an extra 1% brain power. And, you know, it's all about like the things you can do to make yourself better quicker. So it's all about quick stuff. Whereas what I got the sense with your book, you know, The Muse, The Unconscious, this is not quick stuff. Do you know what I mean? It's much deeper. So why... Why now? Like, why this deeper book?
You know, I, as you know, Joanna, I'm a believer in following the muse, as we'll talk about in this interview, you know, which is, you know, something unconscious that prompts you from within. I'm definitely a believer in writing from the inside out. Rather, in other words, what is coming up from your own heart or coming up from that source in you, rather than trying to suss out the marketplace, you know, trying to look for, well, what is, you know, what could I sell? What could I get over? You know, which is why I hate that whole hacking mentality, which to me is not, it's not really writing. It's not really being a writer. It's something else, you know. But my whole way of looking at writing is that it's a lifetime pursuit, whether you're making money or not, you know, whether like, as Elizabeth Gilbert said, that promise that she made to herself when she started writing, that she said to her writing, I will never ask you to support me. I will support you. And that's a real lifetime commitment of a real writer, right? So I don't know, this book just sort of came out of, I actually wrote it a couple of years ago. It's been kind of sitting around and I kind of re-energized it or retweaked it. But it is spiritual. It is really about that writing from the inside out.
Yeah, definitely. And I've picked some quotes from the book that I particularly, that touched me. So the first one is, and you just mentioned here, the artist's work evolves over her lifetime. Her subject remains the same. And that's fascinating to me. So what do you mean by subject? And how does that relate to an author's voice? Like, what stays the same and what develops?
That's a great question. Like I said to you before, I don't know if I could answer it. But if you think about the works of, say, Philip Roth, you know, if you could put all of his books up together, or the albums of Bruce Springsteen, or the albums of Joni Mitchell, and you look at them all together, let's say you start with Philip Roth. He definitely has a subject, right? It runs through all the books. He might define it a little differently than I would, but I would say it was like what it means to be a male Jew in America in the 20th and 21st century. How does that fit in? And every book from Portnoy's Complaint, Goodbye Columbus, all the way up to The Dying Animal and his, you know, his last few books were on that subject. That was sort of, and he changed the way he attacked that subject. You know, like in Portnoy's Complaint, he did this zany, crazy, almost stand-up comic thing. And by the end of his life, he was doing very, very serious, totally scholarly examinations of the same subject. And if you look at, let's say, the albums of Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan or something like that, they're basically on the same subject. They just sort of attack it from a different dimension. And I think my theory on this, Joanna, is that the artist doesn't really have a choice here. If they're following their muse, it's not like, I think Philip Roth could have said, you know, I'm going to write about, I don't know, feminist, whatever, you know, it wasn't really burning in his guts to get it out, you know? So I think our subject sort of chooses us in a way. And I think that, you know, the artist journey, the title of the book, is really about that odyssey that we go through, that internal odyssey that we go to after we've committed to being a writer, after, you know, we've had that turning pro moment, that come to Jesus moment, when we sort of stop messing around and wasting our life. And from that point on, we kind of dedicate ourselves to finding our voice and that sort of thing. And also finding our subject. And so I think at that point, whether we start asking ourselves or not, or whether it just evolves, the question, the foremost question in our mind is, what is my subject? What was I put on this earth to write about? I think when you see somebody like Philip Roth or Bob Dylan or Bruce Springsteen, you can say of them, they found their subject, right? They hit it and they were on it right from the start.
Yeah. So what's your subject then? Because having, you know, you do have, you have quite a, well, you have war and conflict in so many of your books, whether it's external conflict, you know, the Israel war, you've got your ancient wars, you've got the war of art. Is war your subject?
I think it is, but not so much in the sense of soldiers fighting on a battlefield as it is for me the internal war of the artist against his or her own self-sabotage and his or her own fear. And, you know, I was at the gym the other day and a friend of mine said to me, life is a battle, you know, and he was just talking about the gym. But I think it is a battle. I mean, I can certainly see that many other people live their lives in different ways. A mother might feel that life is about bringing forth new life and nurturing new life. Or someone might also say life is about love and about opening, et cetera, et cetera. Many ways you look at it. But for me, it is a battle. I mean, when I get up every morning, I sort of feel that dragon there in my head. And I know that if I don't slay it that day, I'm not going to be very happy that night. And it's too bad we couldn't have Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain here right now to talk about that subject. But I think you're right. That is kind of my subject. And whether I'm writing about writing or ancient warfare or whatever, it does seem to be about conflict and the inner battle against one's own fear and hesitation and all those temptations to be less than you can be.
Mm. Well, then, so I wanted
give less than you can give.
Mm. So then I wanted to ask you, because you write both fiction and nonfiction, and this is something whenever I read your stuff, I struggle with, because you have this idea of a shadow career. And sometimes, you know, I write books for authors, you write books for authors, and not that I would put myself next to you, but I'm just like...
I don't put myself next to you, Joanne. It's an honor to be here with you.
Oh, you're so sweet. But whenever I write a nonfiction book, I feel like, in a way, I'm helping my audience, and I'm trying to share some of my experience and what I go through. And then, but when I write fiction, I feel like it's in some way selfish, but it's more respecting the muse. So how does your subject go through both your fiction and your nonfiction, and how do you balance those two?
That's a really great question. And as I was reading it, when you said it, I thought, I don't know how I'm going to answer that. I mean, certainly I wrote fiction for a long time before I wrote The War of Art. That was, I don't know what, my seventh or eighth book or something like that, which was the first nonfiction book I'd done. And that I only sort of did because I just wanted to get it off my chest, because people kept asking me those questions. And I thought, let me just write a book and then I can put the book in their hands and I want it to be. And then after that, I thought, well, you know, I got to follow it up. There's more to it than that. And so it's just sort of evolved on its own. But I do think I sort of go to a different place in fiction. I'm sure you do too, in my head. And it does feel like, I don't know if it's a different muse, but it's a different something. I mean, it's almost like, I would say nonfiction is almost like writing an op-ed piece or writing an essay, where you're really not creating characters, you're not creating a world, you're not inventing a narrative, you're speaking in your own voice. It's sort of as though someone says to you, Joanna, I'm stuck on this thing. Help me. What should I do? And so you answer out of your own Joanna knowledge, which is really, I don't know if it really is the muse. I guess it is, because it all comes from there. Mm-hmm. But you're sort of answering, I think, out of your real experiences in this real world. Whereas for me, fiction, you're digging deep into areas you don't even know where it's coming from, you know? I feel that about my fiction, that I don't know where the characters are coming from. I don't know what's going to come out of their mouths. And so that's a sort of a deeper surrender to that sort of improv-ish, you know, what's going to happen next when you open the box. You know?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I almost feel like it's a different mindset. And that's why I like using two different names, because I feel like, by scheduling my JF Penn time. Great. Yeah, I can almost go into that. But I did. So let's just talk about going deeper. So you say the artist is being driven from a far deeper and more primal source than the conscious intellect. So how do we tap into the primal source? Like, how do we go down a level when we're so concerned with, you know, just daily stuff going on?
That's another great question. And of course, everybody does it in a different way. How it's like, how do you dream, or how do you have an intuition? I remember that they did a story, and I live in Los Angeles, and they did a story in the LA Times a few years ago about where they asked screenwriters where they worked, you know, office, whatever. And they asked five of them, and three of them said they worked in their cars. And one of them said he or she worked in a car while it was moving. So I don't know. In other words, everybody kind of gets at it in a different way. To me, it sort of starts with the idea for whatever the book is. You know, if you have, and that's really the muse speaking to you, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm always on the lookout for a new idea. And I'm always sort of asking myself, what's percolating under there? And I also find a lot of times an idea will come to me, say in January, and I'll sort of make a note in my head and I'll completely dismiss it. Forget it completely. And then like 3 months later, I go, whatever, that idea I had back in January. And I look at it and I go, oh, you know, that's a pretty good idea. And then I'll start focusing on it. So let's say you have an idea to do something about Queen Boudica of early Britannia. Then I think you just, in your own way, this is my experience, you begin to surrender to that. You start researching it, mm-hmm. and you begin to sort of surrender to that idea. And I think you start outlining it or blocking it in the broadest strokes. Mm. And I think there's a mystical sort of process happens there. And tell me if you did the same thing happens with you, Joanna. As you start to work on something, a sort of gravitational field begins to form around you, and it begins to attract stuff. Mm. Ideas. You're in the shower and you'll think, oh, what if Queen Boudica, you know, fell into a pit of snakes when she was 3 weeks old, whatever, you know? And you don't know, where does that come from? I don't know where. But that accretes along with everything else. And pretty soon you've opened a pipeline to that part of you that's trying to tell that story. Mm. And then it's a process, I think, of sort of getting out of its way and letting it come through. I know that's kind of airy, fairy, and mystical, but that's certainly the process for me. And that's why I say, for the way I write, I'm not a writer for hire. You know, it's not like somebody calls me up and says, can you do me something about whatever? You know, I'm a spec writer. And I write what comes out of me and just bet on myself that I can sell it, you know? Mm. So I do follow the muse, and I am looking for that. You know, it's that old analogy of it's a radio station, and you're kind of the signal's coming in, and you're trying to tune the dial to hit that radio station and pick up that signal.
And you have some rituals, don't you, in order to almost
superstitions, yeah,
call those down people. The muse. So tell us now, we've got to acknowledge that your rituals won't work for everyone, that they won't just automatically mean that the muse will arrive, but what do you do to kind of start that process when you get to your desk or wherever you work?
Yeah, right here, right where I am. Well, let me answer that by recommending a book to your listeners if they haven't heard of this book yet. It's by Twyla Tharp, The Creative Habit. Twyla Tharp is a famous choreographer. And when she calls the book The Creative Habit, and her thing is about habit, about the power of habit, which is like ritual, right? And she talks about how every morning she gets up at the exact same time, 5:30, she's down outside her building in New York City, hailing a cab, going to the gym. And she works out for 2 hours at the gym. And then she comes back to her studio, and then she works for the day. And I think that it doesn't matter so much what your ritual is, but I do think it helps to have a ritual. What I sort of liken it to is, let's say you had a yoga practice, just your own self, right? And you were fortunate enough that you could build a little yoga studio out in your cottage in Devonshire or whatever it is. And so at a certain hour of the day, you would get on your yoga stuff, and you would walk out to the thing, and you would make sure it was clean and well lighted, and you'd open the door, you'd do a little bow before you And you might even say a little prayer to the gods of yoga or whatever it is that you were trying, and you'd set an intention for yourself. And when you entered that space, you would consider that you were entering a sacred space. And then you would begin your yoga, and your practice would be intending to connect with, you know, not just doing the physical part, but to connect to a spiritual dimension of yourself. And I think that's sort of what writers do, or actors do, or choreographers do. And so my ritual is pretty simple. I go to the gym. I'm like Twilight Tharp. I go to the gym. Mm-hmm. I come home. I answer my email and stuff like that. And then I just sit down and just plunge right into it. And when I start making mistakes from fatigue, typos, then I stop and I don't try any harder. Let me ask you, Joanna, what's your ritual?
Oh, no, this is not for me. No, I do. I wear noise cancelling headphones and I play Rain and Thunderstorms. I've been playing the same album for like 10 years now.
Really? No kidding. Well, now, why do you do that? What's the point?
Well, like you say, it cuts out bad noise, like other noises. And just I think the repetition, it's like you say, the repetition of a sound or a something puts you in a place where your brain goes, oh, now I'm doing this. Now I'm writing.
Right. Yeah. Because the whole point of it, I think, what you do and what I do, is a turning inside. Mm. It's an interior thing. Like one of the things I say in the artist's journey is that I used to write at a desk that faced a wall. And people would say to me, why don't you turn a desk around and you'll look outside and see the scenery? But I said, I don't want to see the scenery because I'm in here, you know, just like you with your noise canceling headphones.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that, because I do a lot of traveling for book research, as you know, I know you do. Yeah. For some of your, and I love traveling. Like we were in Madrid last week and it was just amazing. We were in Toledo, you know, Jewish, old Jewish place. And and it was amazing. And people are like, oh, you must write so much when you're traveling. And I'm like, I can't write while I'm traveling. I have to be back in my routine, in my kind of boring, repetitive space. Yeah. Do you find the same thing?
I exactly. You know, I every now and then I can write on the road, but it's pretty rare. And when I can, I sort of bring my own little version of my own space to that thing. And if I have where do I have my little? I have my little cannon here that I use to fire inspiration into myself. So I bring my cannon with me, and I set it up. But one other thing I do want to say, as far as rituals and stuff like that, which is very important for me, is one of my earliest mentors, Paul Rink, gave me a copy of The Invocation of the Muse from T.E. Lawrence's translation of the Odyssey. The very start where Homer says, you know, oh, divine poesy, goddess, daughter of Zeus, et cetera, et cetera. And I say that prayer every morning, you know, out loud. So I really am like invoking the muse and saying, you know, help me. I need help. And here I am, you know, I'm reporting for duty, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Do you, and this is, you know, I didn't send you this question, but do you think the muse is a feminine force?
Yes, without a doubt. I don't know why I say that, but why did the Greeks say, well, you know, there were nine muses. They were nine sisters, the daughters of Zeus and Mnemosyne, which means memory. Mm. And so I guess I agree with them. I think it seems to be a feminine thing to inspire.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. So another thing that I really loved, the artist is not expressing himself. He is discovering himself. And you talk about the daemon, or the Greek, you know, not demon, the daemon, the genius, right. Having an aspect of the monstrous, which I really love, because as part of my writing, I've discovered things that are quite dark and disturbing within myself that sometimes makes me want to self-censor and not put those things in the world. So how do we discover that daemon, that genius? And what if we find stuff that doesn't really fit?
I think the only answer is to kill yourself. No, I don't really know the answer to that. But Let's go back to the concept of the daimon, because if your listeners haven't heard of this, it's an interesting thing. The Greeks, daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, was in the ancient Greeks, a kind of an inhering spirit that we were born with. And the Romans had the same concept, and their word for it was genius. Genius. That was what was in. So I'm definitely a believer that we're born as fully formed individuals. We're not a blank slate, and we've got a destiny, and we got to have a calling. And our daimon, sort of like, I got this from a book called The Soul's Code by James Hillman, another book I highly recommend. And he likens it to an acorn. The daimon's kind of like an acorn. Even as we're as infants, we've got this destiny inside us, just like an acorn contains the entire oak tree already. And the daimon will, I used to work in advertising, as I say in the book, and I would quit, write a novel, it would fail or wouldn't be published. I'd come crawling back to advertising, work again, save money, quit again, et cetera, et cetera. I did that like three different times. And every time I would do that, get ready to quit, that is, my boss, with good intentions, different bosses, would call me into the office and say to me, Steve, why are you throwing your life away? You know, we'll promote you. We'll give you a bonus, blah, blah. And each time I thought, you know, they're right. Why am I going off to write this stupid stuff that nobody wants to read, et cetera, et cetera. But every time I quit, and every time I did go off and write another book, and that's the daimon. That was that thing inside me that just, against all logic, you know, compelled me to do that. So I do think that you know, Bruce Springsteen's daimon made him do whatever it was he did, you know? Anybody that we want to look to and that really had a career. But the daimon is monstrous. So that's a whole other subject. I don't even want to get into that, Joanna. That's a subject for a whole book. But I will say one tiny thing. I wrote a book called Virtues of War, which was about Alexander the Great's career. And I wrote it in the first person as Alexander. And he was somebody who had a daimon that really drove him to, you know, to conquer the world. And it contained the monstrous. And he knew it. And so that's sort of the classic mega daimon that we could find through history.
Well, no, it's interesting because I've been kind of writing on and off for several years now, a book about the shadow, like the shadow side. And I know you know all about Carl Jung and that. And because I just find that I think it's a very similar idea, a monstrous daimon or the collective unconscious, the darkness that we write from. But I think I think there is some aspect, I hope you don't mind, but some aspect of the monstrous in your warlike side of writing and your fiction. Some of the topics you pick really are, you know, that they are violent and they are that monstrous side. You're just such a lovely man, Steve. So I'm going to push you on it.
You don't know me very well.
No, but there is maybe the point, and this is what I partly also want to push you on. It's like, how do you feel that in yourself? Like you have to almost let the monstrous out in your writing, and then put it back in when you do, you know, stuff
I
in your nonfiction.
True. You know, I had a dream not long ago, and I know dreams are really boring, but here's the gist of it. I sort of encountered this monster who was sort of like the Phantom of the Opera, somebody that kind of lived in the darkness and had a face that was sort of half covered by a mask. And everybody in the dream was absolutely terrified of this monster. They kept him in a kind of a cage, and machine guns were trained on him constantly. But at one point in this dream, the monster sang. He just sang like three notes. And even in the dream, those notes were so beautiful that even in the dream, you sort of were mesmerized and surrendered to them. And you thought, there's no way we can ever kill this thing if it can produce that beauty. So that's sort of, I think, the weird part of what we call a monster is also, it's our creative soul, and it's capable of incredible beauty that we can't produce it from any other source, not from any nice guy source. And I don't know, it's a sort of a paradox, a mystery. It's beyond me. But I mean, villains are always the most fun characters.
Yeah, totally.
Right. And I always thought, you know, somebody said to me, could I ever be an actor, or would somebody ever give me a role? I would say I'd love to play like the most dastardly villain. I don't want to, and I want to have some horrible villain speech, you know, that's the monster, and the monsters can be fun if you keep them a little bit under control.
I think that control aspect is probably the balance. I think of Plato's Chariot with the black horse and the white horse.
Yeah.
And having to keep them in balance. And if you let one take over, like maybe coming back to Bourdain, then you can end up going off the road. But if you let just the white horse go along, you know, you end up going off the road the other way.
Right.
So it's a very difficult balancing act. But in terms of balancing act, you do have another thing which I think is interesting. This is not a political show, but you have The Artist is a Force for Unity. And I thought that was fascinating because we have so much or so little empathy at the moment, it seems, between split political realities where people can't seem to imagine the other person's point of view. So how can we use our writing in unity?
I think it's a great question, Joanna. I think that we don't need to do this consciously. If we're true to what inspires us, what will come out will be a force for unity. But here's how I mean that. Mm. I think that what art is all about, like a great, let me think of, there was a movie, an Iranian movie called A Separation. Did you ever see that a little while ago?
No.
Anyway, I think it won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film a couple of years ago. And it was just about, a family in Tehran where the father was coming down with Alzheimer's, and how it split the son and his wife. And what was so great about this movie was, here we are in America, you know, we're afraid of Iran, they're going to bomb us, whatever, right? And they hate us, we're the great Satan. When you saw this movie, and you saw these people, you empathize with them so naturally. There was no way not to. Your heart went out to them. You completely related to their problem. And this was the artist's gift to us, really. And that's what I mean by unity. There was no way, after you see that movie, that you could say the Iranian people are enemies of the United States or whatever. You know, they're just like us. We're just like them. We're all, you know. So I think The Artist is a force for unity in that a great novel, or even just a halfway decent novel, takes you into the lives of other people and helps you identify with people that you might never meet, never know, never have, you know, across centuries, whatever. Hmm. So that's why I think the artist's role. We laugh at artists a lot of times, and we think even of ourselves, we think, why am I wasting my being an artist? Nobody's buying my books, whatever. But the artist is a real force for good over the long haul. And he or she is a force for unity. Painter, filmmaker, dancer, you name it, because it's the artist's gift is the gift of empathy, and to show us something that we can no longer say, that's not us. That's us too. That's what I meant by that. So it's not really political. The artist kind of goes beyond the political. It's above the political.
Yeah, I think that's really the point. It's not like write some preachy thing that is like, I'm right or I think this. It's
right.
As you say,
if it gets preachy, you better stop.
Yeah, it's human. And the point that I think, it feels like humans are not binary most of the time. Everyone's really everyone's really complicated.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned The Long Haul there, and I did again, and Turning Pro, which I reread, I've read so many times, but you have this theme to come back to, which is the artist learns to commit for a lifetime. And again, the artist's journey. Now, again, sort of circling back to the hacking, you know, there's this myth of the publishing industry that you write a bestseller, you make a million, you can retire. But you talk about it taking 17 years to earn your first penny through writing. So what are your thoughts on patience? Like, how can we be patient when we might, our ambition or our daemon wants something and it might take a long time to get there?
Well, I don't know if this is true for other people, but I have to say for me, I just had no choice. I mean, along those 17 years, like I say, many, many crossroads appeared where I could said, all right, let me take this job. Let me settle, let me just settle for something else, but I could never do it. I just didn't have a choice. I was so depressed and so bored doing, something other than pursuing what my own daemon was telling me to do. And that the sort of, again, the hacking concept is that's seeing writing from the outside in, where you say, what does the marketplace want? Oh, horror is big this year. So, and of course, this is what movie studio executives, this is their whole job, So, and then so you write a horror thing. But that's not being a writer, and it's not being true to your daemon or your muse. So if you're going from the inside out, you're asking, well, what's coming up out of me now? What am I being led towards? And if you think of it that way, you have to have patience. And you have to think about it as, even if, like, I'll go back to Liz Gilbert and her saying, I'm not going to ask you, my writing, to support me. I'm going to support you. Mm-hmm. You can produce, like, I see all your books behind you there, your body of work. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason why anybody that's listening to this or watching this right now, that why they can't have a body of work exactly as good or more. And you're going to go on and on and on and continue to do more and more and more. And it's, the concept of the artist's journey is that we are artists and we have this journey inside us. Those books behind you are the fruits of your journey. And so that even, and particularly these days where anybody can publish, right? You don't really have to have that can be one's body of work that you produce over a lifetime. Even if you're a lawyer or a doctor or a mom or whatever, this is what you were put here to do. So that's for me what I mean by patience, or what you mean by patience.
Yeah.
You don't have a choice. If you're going to be true to it, once you start on this road, you can't really turn back, without really abandoning your own self.
Yeah. And I feel like I first put out my first book 10 years ago, and it does just feel like yesterday. But I was going to ask you, because when I was emailing you and trying to work out.
Joanna, you probably got 30, 40, 50 years ahead of you.
I hope so.
Think about that. Need a bigger bookshelf.
But it's interesting thinking about who we were and who we become on this discovery of ourselves, because in our emails, you mentioned that some of the screenplays you wrote in the early days are not necessarily things that you would associate with yourself anymore. So how do you reconcile that learning and discovery over the journey with your idea that you're born with this acorn, I guess?
That's another great question. At one point I worked on a porno movie.
Awesome.
Some of the jobs I've done in advertising are unbelievably sort of off the mark, but it's all you learn. I remember when I first got out to Hollywood, the first job I got, I was working with an old time director named Ernie Pintoff, who became a sort of a mentor to me. And he just said to me, keep working. And this is sort of actually a mantra for actors as much as for writers. Mm-hmm. Take the next role, you learn on everything. And at some point, the daemon will kick in. I've written so much stuff that was really not me, but it's a learning process. And you really do learn in every job, And then at some point, maybe the muse is circling overhead and looking down and saying, nah, she's not ready quite yet, got to do a few more of these terrible things. And then at some point, maybe the muse says, She's ready. She's paid her dues. So now I can start to give her some good stuff.
It's so interesting, these things. You know, you think when you put a book out there, you're like, this is the best I can do. But it's not the best you can do in 10 years time or in 20 years time. So
right. Do you look back on your earlier stuff and say, oh, man, I could have done so much better if I had.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what I do is I look at my reviews on Amazon, and if I'm still getting good reviews on the old books, I'm like, it's fine.
Yeah, that's true.
So that helps.
Still cool enough, Joanna.
Yeah, exactly. But also, you know, they say if you're not slightly embarrassed by what you did last year or the year before, you're not moving on.
Yeah, but I'm not embarrassed by any of it. I'm you know, it's all part of the process, you know?
Yeah.
It's all part of the learning process.
Yeah. So we're almost out of time, but last question, because I always like to ask you about marketing, because, you know, you do everything and you go from the spiritual to, you know, the actual marketing side. And like you say, you worked in advertising. So you're very aware of all the business side. Now, you've been serializing this book on your blog at stephenpressfield.com. And many authors feel that that is giving the book away for free. So why serialize the whole book? And why is blogging still important to you?
Well, you're asking the wrong question in terms of marketing, Joanna. I'm like the worst marketer. The only one worse is my partner, Sean Coyne. You know, we're terrible. We just don't know what we're doing. We're bumbling around. Nothing ever works for us. And I really only put it out on the blog because I didn't have any other thing. I forgot what else to do. You know, I had this whole book and I thought, I'll just serialize it. But I am definitely a believer in getting. I don't believe in hoarding stuff. Oh, let's keep this. You know, I think the real problem that we all face is that nobody knows our stuff is even there. You know, it's not like, oh, people are stealing our great stuff, you know. So I'm happy to put something out there. I mean, I don't know if I would serialize a novel because I don't think like only three people would, you know, stay tuned all the way through, you know. But I think a book like The Artist's Journey, you can serialize and hopefully people will still want to buy an actual copy when all is said and done. But even if they don't, you know, but I'm a terrible marketer, Joanna. I look to you as you know, the guru of how to do this. But it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to get something out there for all of us.
Well, I guess the point is that many authors starting out now would say, well, why would I bother starting a blog? And I would say, you know, well, Stephen Pressfield has a blog, so why wouldn't a new author start a blog? I mean, do you still think the writing itself can be your marketing out there?
The writing of the blog, you mean?
Yeah, the blog is more shareable than the book, isn't it, in that way?
It is, and I certainly think it's a great. My motivation in blogging is not so much, you know, I hear people say, oh, I really want to help people. I really want to teach people. I really don't. That's not my motivation at all. Because I think that the writer who is a born writer, they're going to write anyway. Nothing can stop them, you know. And if they're not, they're going to fade away anyway. But I sort of do it almost to teach myself that, you know, and to explore what do I think about villains. Why don't I do a series of like 12 posts about villains? And I do find that it's very helpful. You start to get in there and you go, oh, I never realized that, you know, or you watch a movie and you go, that was a great speech that Jeremy Irons gave. And, you know, what can we learn from that? So I'm really sort of blogging for my own benefit. And I hope people profit from it and like it, but I'm really doing it for myself. And I do think that the newer beginning writer should do it. Gets you into your own, it makes you ask yourself, what do I really think? What do I really know? What do I think about this? Why, you know, it's easy we can come up with an opinion, but then if someone says, well, why do you think that? A lot of times you don't know. And it's good to ask that question and answer it.
That's probably why I end up writing another nonfiction book, because I want to know what I think. But anyway, look, where can people find The Artist's Journey and all of your books and everything you do online?
It's on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or all that stuff. Or my little company with my partner, Sean, is called Black Irish Books. And if you just Google that, Black Irish Books, you know, you can get all of our stuff there.
Fantastic.
And It's not cheaper, but if you want to buy like a bundle of ebook, audiobook, and paperback, then it is cheaper.
Did you narrate the audiobook, this one?
Yeah, there's an audiobook of this, yeah.
Fantastic. I've got the Turning Pro one. And
yeah,
I think that's awesome.
I think audio is kind of the few thing of the present and the future, I think.
Oh, it's fantastic. So thanks so much for your time, Steve. That was great.
Thank you, Joanna. Thanks for the great questions. It's always great to talk to you and, you know, hang out with you. It's great.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Stephen Pressfield today, and remember to go check out his new book, The Artist's Journey. Now, next week, I'll be talking to paramedic Samantha Keel about how to write effective injuries for your characters. And also we'll be talking about some fascinating insights into the transgender experience. So that is coming up next week. If you want to binge on dark fantasy, go check out the limited time story bundle at storybundle.com/fantasy. Right, happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.